Unlabeled Leadership is a volunteer service. We appreciate our guests for their stewardship and remarkable stories. We also appreciate listeners like you who back the show with star reviews and contributions.
Gary DePaul with Unlabeled Leadership. Welcome to episode 132, Mike Bassett and the Life Lessons from the Ditch. Here's a shout out to listeners in California, in Garden Grove, Imperial Beach, Irvine, Pleasant Hill, and Pasadena, and in Texas, Mansfield and Yoakum. With that, let's get started. Imagine, you're in physical pain. You've been injured, and it hurts. Just as you think it's getting better, you re-injure that same spot, and it hurts even more. And just as you think you're recovering from that, you're not. It gets worse, and then worse. That is the experience of being at the bottom of the ditch. Sometimes it's self-inflicted, other times life just happens. The circumstances just don't align with where you should be. Mike Bassett is a civil trial lawyer with more than 34 years experience, but around 2002, something really bad happened, and he talks about it in his book, The Man in the Ditch. He lives in Texas, where he runs the Bassett Firm. He's a podcaster, speaker, and as I just mentioned, an author. After this recording session, I wanted to find out a little bit more about Mike. I called his law firm, and I asked the receptionist, what are three words that describe Mike, his character? I was put on hold, and she came back and with confidence said, hardworking, ambitious, and kind. I think that's a fair summary of who Mike is and what he offers. Part 1. Do it right. Simply by existing, we influence. Whether it's with something we say or model how to do something, knowingly or unknowingly, we influence other people's behaviors. Often, when we try to influence someone deliberately, it doesn't work. And ironically, when we're not trying to influence someone, we unintentionally do that. If you're lucky, someone will come up to you and say, you know, 10 years ago when you said whatever it was, that changed my life. Mike shares a story from his childhood when his father influenced him. Here's Mike.
Growing up, I was the youngest of five. We were all adopted, and we lived in the Upper Valley in El Paso. It's in the middle of the desert, but it's a green part of the desert. My dad and I were out raking leaves one morning, and there always seemed like there were leaves to be raked. And I remember my dad saying to me distinctly, Michael, any job worth doing is worth doing right. Now, 11 or 12-year-old me rolled my eyes and, muttered, God, when are these leaves ever going to stop falling? I got to tell you, Gary, that has really stuck with me. And I think it has come home to roost in my job as a lawyer because I think it's especially important because people come to me and come to our law firm only when they have problems. Nobody calls me and says, hey, Mike, we had a great quarter. Nothing happened. We don't need you. So my role that I view is to be a problem solver and not a problem creator, which means if somebody gives me a job to do, they expect me to do it right. And the corollary to that statement that my dad used to tell me was this one, Michael, if you want to do the bigger things, you need to do the little things well. So those are two core beliefs and mantras that I continue to reflect back on today.
When you hear do the little things well, that kind of implies the little things accumulate and build up to become big things.
It has been that way in my practice. Nobody hires you as an unknown quantity on a huge bet the company case. They hire you on a smaller item. And if you do well, then they'll hire you on bigger items. Just like I use this analogy all the time with our lawyers. I remember when our sons, who are now in their 30s, started driving. At first, they could drive to a friend's house and back during the day. And if they did that well, then they could drive to school. And if they did that well, maybe I would let them drive to a friend's house and stay the night and progressively gave them more and more responsibility. If you wrecked the car on the way to your friend's house the first time or came back 2 hours late, you were not going to the next level.
That makes sense. And I could see that even in a lot of things, being an entrepreneur, writing a book. I mean, if you're writing a book, if you can do an outline, then something small, but it's progressive. And if you can write a couple of pages on each point on the outline, then it gets you closer until you have a finished product.
Yeah. And it's funny, I call that my biggest challenge, and this may be for some of your listeners, is just butt in the seat time.
Yeah.
And so big projects can sometimes intimidate me, but you're absolutely right. Just doing 5 minutes on a project can give you the momentum to maybe carry you forward for another 30 minutes or an hour.
Part two, in dark moments. In my book, 9 Practices of 21st Century Leadership, I talk about 7 leadership principles. Over the years, I come to think of these almost as secrets, like 7 secrets of leadership. The reason has to do with how obvious they sound. Believe in others, connect with others, put others first. They're simple concepts, yet there's a lot of depth to them, and they're hard to internalize. I mean, really internalize into guiding your daily practices. Much of the time, life leads us, but when we internalize those principles, amazing things can happen. Sometimes we find ourselves in difficult situations and we make poor choices, but from those poor choices and from those situations, we develop and internalize a deeper meaning to those 7 leadership principles. Mike shares his amazing story about what happened to him, and I'll let him explain. Again, here's Mike.
Gary, my example of leadership comes from a really bad decision I made 20 years ago, which nearly cost me my freedom and my law license.
Okay, that's pretty heavy to start.
Yeah. In 1994, I had been out of law school for a whopping 7 years. I got hired to represent a trucking company, and my point of contact at the trucking company was the director of claims, a gentleman named Sam. Sam hired our small firm on little things, and as things often work out, we got to go to bigger things. Another lawyer and I split off from our firm and formed our own firm in 1996, and Sam's business followed us. We were representing Sam all over the state. Sam was one of those guys that was very, very well known in the transportation industry, and he had a very national footprint because all of the companies whose claims he adjusted ran through all 48 states. And he was very generous. Sam was a very hands-on client. If there were depositions or if there were mediations, he would come in the night before. Gary and he and I many times had dinner together, and during the course of all those dinners, I got to know Sam and I got to know his family. He got to know my family. And in fact, he came out to my house and broke bread with my family and even went to mass with my wife and 2 sons and I. And I thought Sam had gone from a client to a friend. In 2001, I got a large package at the office from Sam, which was not uncommon because he was very generous in that way. And inside were a bunch of Green Bay Packers swag, signed jerseys, signed football, team prints, stuff that he knew my sons would love, and they did. And I called him and said, Sam, man, this is so nice. Thank you for doing it. And he said, of course, happy to do it. And that's just the way he was. And he said, did you get what I sent you? And I said, no, I listed what was in the box. He said, no, there's something in there for you. So I pulled everything out of the box. And sure enough, Gary, there was a check or an envelope with 3 checks in it. They were made payable to me, but not on cases I was working. So I told Sam, hey, there's a mix up here. These checks are made payable to me and they never are made payable to me. They're made payable to the firm. And Sam, I don't recognize any of these case names. He said, no, those checks are meant for you. Here's what I want you to do. I want you to take those checks, Mike, and I want you to run them through your firm's trust account. And I want you to give me 75% of the money and you keep 25%. And I said, well, we're not going to do that. He said, well, here's the deal. The checks are made payable to you. Why don't you just cash the checks and give me the money, a little over $10,000? And I said, Sam, I'm not going to do that either. We were close enough that I said, Sam, do you need me to lend you $10,000? Do you need the money? And then his tone changed, Gary, and he said, listen, here's what you're going to do. You're going to take those checks, you're going to cash them, and you're going to give me the money. And if you don't, I'm going to tell everybody in the transportation industry that you have lost it, and I'm going to pull every bit of business I have from your law firm, which at that point, if I remember, was about $500,000 a year. One of the lessons I have learned is that morality and ethics, legal, religious, or otherwise, are sometimes pretty weak when the reward for doing wrong or the fear of doing what is right is big enough. So I cashed the checks and I gave him the money. And I thought that that would blow over and that we would go on. And of course, that's not what happened. In 2002, during a routine audit, Sam's employer found out that he had been embezzling money for a year to the tune of over $1 million.
Oh, boy.
I learned later that he would send checks to lawyers all over the country because, remember, he had cases all over the country. And most of those lawyers would take those checks and run them through their trust account and keep 25% and give him 75%. Those transactions, as I understand it, went into the hundreds of thousands of dollars. Long, long story short, Gary, the FBI got involved. I ended up getting charged with federal criminal charges. I had two grievances filed against me, one by Sam's former employer and one by my former firm. Through the help of two great lawyers, Jim Burnham and Martin Lenore, I was able to plead guilty to one count in the federal court case. I got a public reprimand from the state bar, which means that I could continue to practice law. And then we opened our law firm, the Bassett Firm, in 2002 with 5 employees and 162 cases. Only 2 clients stuck with me. The rest of them left me. And I understand it because I was radioactive. Fast forward 20 years, we now have 14 lawyers, I think 38 or 39 people on staff. And last week we opened case number 3,744. While these are all good things, Gary, I'm most thankful for my time in the ditch when I was in those dark spaces, because that time there really allowed me to reflect on myself and hopefully become a better lawyer and a better person.
When things are really at their worst, it seems that that is when the most learning happens. When you're outside of your comfort zone, whether you want it or not, that is where growth and people really come to terms with certain principles. Is that what you experienced?
Absolutely. There's a quote that I like to use by Malcolm Muggeridge, who is a British broadcaster and writer. And he essentially says this: the only true learning that I have ever done in my life was as a result of suffering. And I think that that's true for me. And I think that that's true for almost everybody that I've encountered after I've shared my story and visited with. Those dark moments, Gary, are going to come upon all of us, regardless of who you are. Because one of the things I truly believe is everybody, no matter what your socioeconomic status is or where you are or where you went to school, we are all one left turn away from being in the ditch. And I think that if we process those dark moments, we can come out the other side a better version of ourselves, or we can remain bitter and small. But the wonderful thing that I often tell people is we have a choice. And I think that we can take those dark moments and really help them transform us into better versions of ourselves.
When people experience unusual hardship, when things look the bleakest, when someone loses a spouse or all the family members, when they lose all their income, when they go into bankruptcy, when they have creditors coming at them from all angles, when they're being hunted down by gang members or whatever, it seems that there's a message that you're giving that no matter how bleak it seems, that there is an opportunity for two things to happen. One is for you to discover principles and beliefs that will guide your life from here on out. And that's a learning experience. But just as important, there is some hope that even as bleak as things seem, there's an end to it, but the end doesn't have to be self-destructive or doesn't have to be necessarily a final end.
You know, you're absolutely right. And I will tell you that if I did not believe in my faith that there was a life after this life, I probably would have taken my life several times. I'm just being honest during these dark times. But what I hope is that everybody comes to the realization that you will find yourself in the ditch. There's nothing you can do to inoculate yourself from that. I used to think that you could, but you cannot. And my message is absolutely right. Like you said, no matter how dark the hour, there will be a better day ahead. And I think the key is not to go it alone. We can take those moments and really transform us into a better version of ourselves. And more importantly, very more importantly, be somebody that can help other people in this pilgrimage that we call life.
Part 3, teachings and advice from the bottom of the muddy, craggy ditch. There's a lot that we can learn from our challenging situations. Mike shares some of the things that he learned from being at the bottom of the ditch, and then shares some practical advice. Here's Mike.
After my time in the ditch, I came away with a lot of realizations and a lot of lessons that I maybe had learned as a younger man, but relearned again at the muddy, craggy bottom of the ditch. I discussed them in my book called The Man in the Ditch, and I list 9 lessons that I learned during those life-altering times. But I think, Gary, I think it can all be boiled down to 3 key leadership lessons that I have learned. The first being, lead your people with empathy and compassion. And I think that the best way to express this is in a quote from Cornel West, who's a philosopher and social activist, who said this, and I think it's just so powerful. You can't lead the people if you don't love the people. You cannot save the people if you don't serve the people. That is paradoxical to a lot of people who embrace this masculine idea of leadership. But unless your people know on some level that you love them, I don't think that they will ever follow you.
What you're not saying is, as a manager going to the people that report to you and say, I love you, you're saying, correct me if I'm wrong, that you want to show your love by your actions.
Oh, absolutely. I think it was St. Francis of Assisi once said, preach often, speak if you must. And so I think that people are going to watch the way we treat them and what we say to them, more importantly than going directly to them and telling them our feelings for them.
That also does another thing. It models that type of behavior.
Exactly. Whether you like it or not, as a leader of an organization, your emotions and your reactions get modified and amplified the further down the food chain they go in any organization. So my second lesson, Gary, is really about perspective. And I will tell a very brief story that I tell in my book. Through a weird series of consequences, I ended up having lunch with Herb Kelleher.
Oh.
Of course, everybody knows one of the founders of Southwest Airlines. And I was able to have lunch with him. And I said, Mr. Keller, could you give me some insights as how to really be a better lawyer and run a better law firm? And he said, Mike, I'll tell you what, you know, when I come into the office every day, I ask 2 questions. Do you know what they are? And I said, no, sir, I don't. He said, the first thing I come in is ask my number one assistant, how many takeoffs did we have yesterday? And he'll give me a number. And I'll say, how many landings did we have yesterday? And he'll give me a number. And if those 2 numbers match, it is going to be a great day. We all need to keep things in perspective, because in this job, in whatever profession you have, sometimes the pressures can get to us and the little things can seem like the big things. But as my late mother used to say, this too shall pass. One of the things I have learned again and again, in a good way and sometimes in a not so good way, is everybody in an organization is looking to the leaders to see how they should process and react to any given situation. If the leader is cool, calm, and collected, has a plan, that will imbue a sense of confidence in those below you. But if you are constantly yelling, screaming, if you always appear to be nervous, I think human nature dictates that everybody that works underneath you, Gary, will always be nervous.
It's so easy as a manager, as an owner, as someone who's in a position where they actually have people that they're responsible for, to be caught up in the moments.
Mm-hmm.
That can drive how you react. Some people say, it never would happen to me, but you don't know until you're in that situation. When the principles become really ingrained in you, you're able to navigate in a way that's different from what's dictated from your circumstances, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. And I think a lot of that comes with the being fortunate enough to have lived many years and experienced many losses, because it gives us wisdom.
Yeah.
Because as a 26-year-old lawyer, things that would get me wound absolutely up don't get me wound up anymore. And it's simply because I have more perspective and you begin to know what things really matter and what things really don't. The bottom line, Gary, is not a lot of stuff really matters that much.
I agree.
And my third and final lesson of leadership is this, is that is of embracing a community. Because I have learned, and I have seen again and again with people that have shared their stories with me, that when we are alone, we do not tend to make good decisions. If you don't believe me, watch a pack of hyenas. I was watching the Nat Geo channel the other day, and they were showing these hyenas. When they want to go to get an animal, the first thing they do is separate the prey from the herd. And I think that that's one of the things that happens to us. When we become separated from our community, we do not make good decisions. We need to constantly surround ourselves with people that are our community, and we have to cultivate that. It can happen organically, but it's got to be cultivated, and we need to be very careful and mindful about who we let into our community or let into our tribe. And I use this quote in the book, and I think it's true, that the only way out is through, and the only way through is together.
when you're saying the word community, you're not meaning a physical community like people who gather on a regular basis. While it may be that as part of it, but it's also pick and choose people around you that you can help and that can help you, and that you have mutual beliefs and principles. You realize that you can rely on them and vice versa.
And I think you will know those people, Gary, when you run into them, because it will click. Something in you will click and you say, this is a person that I really would like to get to know. This is somebody that will make me a better person. Just the opposite. You know people that you meet with them and they just drain you emotionally. My experience has been those are not the people you let into your community. To go from the theoretical, Gary, to the more practical, what I call tomorrow morning at your desk kind of stuff, there's really two pieces of advice that I would share with folks that they have probably heard again and again, but maybe I will present it just a little bit differently. One of the things I have learned over the years is that when I am visiting with somebody, now whether it's over Zoom or back pre-pandemic when they were in my office, I have found that I have much richer conversations if I'm doing nothing else but listening to them. When you're on the phone with somebody, Gary, and they're looking at email or they're doing something else, you know they're only half listening. Or when you go into somebody's office and they're constantly looking at papers on your desk while you're trying to talk to them, you realize they're giving you a half measure of attention. And that sends a very, very strong message. And I think that message is, you are not that important to me. And this goes back to what you talked about earlier. One of the ways you can tell your people that you really care about them and love them is to give them your undivided attention, because our time is the most valuable thing that we can give somebody. My second piece of advice is this: just laugh. We all need to laugh more. Not only does it reduce stress, I have found that it lightens my burdens. It gives us hope. More importantly, Gary, it connects us with other people, which I think dovetails into this need for all of us having a community.
Going back to your first advice, it reminds me of something I read by Marshall Goldsmith, where he talked about a president, doesn't matter which one, who was described that when you're talking directly to that president and you're in a room full of people, the recipients of that conversation or the person talking to the president walks away and says, I felt in that moment I was the most important person in the room. I had such unique attention paid to me that it really was astounding. I think about being in the moment, being in a work environment, someone comes in and the need for that person to give that person your total attention, it communicates, I value you. You have something very important to say. I think that gets at the essence of what advice you're giving and why.
I agree. And I have read those stories about that president. And I can tell you, it comes naturally to some people, but I think it can be a learned behavior. And the benefits that you will reap are just amazing.
I think it's a way of expressing love when you can give someone that much attention.
Oh, absolutely. You may never have to say it, but those people know that you care about them and that you have their back. And let's be clear, just because you love your employees does not mean that you don't hold them accountable. It doesn't mean that you don't hold them to task, but you do it in a respectful way so that they know you will always be straight with them.
My thanks to Mike Bassett. If you'd like to learn more about Mike, go to the show notes. And if you have a question or comment, go to unlabeledleadership.com, click the message icon, and leave a voicemail for up to 1 minute. I'd like to thank those who donate to the show. Your contributions makes a difference because this is an all-volunteer service. I'd like to thank you for listening. This is Gary DePaul. Until next time, lead on.